I'm Andrew Bamford. I was born on the 8th of March 1963, and I've lived in Ely for since 1998, but really only started exploring the area around the wild space since about 2005 or so. I'm a conservation scientist by profession in the university, but I'm also a very keen naturalist. And the extraordinary thing for me about this area is just that it's got the combination it has of fantastic little treasures of wildlife alongside such a busy town, which means that lots of local people are able to enjoy it so much. So from my own point of view, as a conservationist, it became pretty clear to me that it was important as a conservation area because of some of the really pretty rare species that you can see there. You don't see them all the time, you come across them once in a while, but when you do, they make you realise it's very important, like otters using the beet pits in the river area in the evening sometimes, and just finding the odd sign of them. I've managed to see them just once. And then, of course, the bitterns being there in the spring and booming in the early summer, and then occasional glimpses of them in the winter. So from that point of view, it was obvious that it was extremely important from a conservation perspective. But as I say, the other thing that was really is really impressive to people who visit the area is just how important it is for local people, and how many people get pleasure in all sorts of different ways from it. And so as a conservationist, that was also very interesting, because to me it shows how conservation and the ability of people to use a place aren't necessarily incompatible. I became quite concerned, along with lots of people, about what was happening in terms of potential risks of development to the area in early 2007, I think it was. And around that time, a group of us got together to collect information just on how many — we thought this was an important part of the jigsaw — how many people use the area. And several people in my research group and lots of colleagues came and helped collect the data. And the numbers that we got from doing those surveys and using a simple technique to work up from the visits we were seeing over a few days to what the visits would have been like over the year as a whole, just by comparing how busy the wild space was at that time with other reserves which have information for the entire year, we came up with a staggering estimate of how many people visit the area. In total, the number of visits in a year seems to be at the order of 90,000, maybe 100,000 visits a year. That's obviously lots of people visiting daily, for example, but also people coming every week or every month or whatever. When you put that alongside ideas for numbers for other reserves and also the visit rates at places like Ely Cathedral, they're of the same order, and you suddenly realise that this area really is very important for large numbers of people. That importance for people has really come home to me time and again at different stages in people's efforts to get the area conserved over time. So, for example, for me, one of the — right in the early days, after concerns about this development were beginning to rise up, I look back and it's one of the most exciting and at the time alarming evenings of my entire life was in May, I think it was in May 2007, where the Ely Wild Space Group wanted to find out how much people, what people in general thought about the prospects for the area becoming more developed, called a public meeting. And when we set out to have it, we thought, well, it's important to get as many people as there as possible, so we did some publicity. So when we were planning the meeting, we knew lots of people were concerned, but we wanted to know Understand their concerns a bit more. We wanted to see how many people wanted to do something about it. In planning that was, well, if we go into a really big venue, then we're good with, then not that many people turn up, we're going to feel like there aren't very many of us. So we need to be careful about where we choose as our venue. So we decided to have it at the Village College. We wanted to meet in the hall, but the hall was taken up with band practice, and so we were the only room we could find was in the library, and we thought that was all right, because if not that many people turned up, it would still make us feel like we were not entirely alone, so that was a good thing. And then that evening, I remember when I got home from the railway station, I got back to Ely that evening, I was amazed because there were loads of people handing out leaflets about the meeting to everyone who was pouring off the trains. And I realised not only were people picking up the leaflets, I didn't even know the people who were handing out the leaflets. There was an army of people raising awareness about the meeting. And then we went on in due course to the school to have the meeting, and it was clear that we weren't going to be able to fit into the library at all. And the band involved very kindly said, oh, it's all right, we'll swap rooms. We can practice with our brass instruments in the library, which is very kind of them. We went into the hall. We got into the hall and carefully drew up the partition so that, again, we wouldn't feel like we were rattling around, a few of us in a huge room. And then as we set out the chairs, we looked out the driveway, and we saw more and more people coming down the driveway, and then more and then more, and the room filled up and filled up. We thought, goodness me, we're going to have to pull back even the partitions. And in the end, opened up the entire hall and couldn't start the meeting because there were still people pouring down the driveway. And the caretaker came and said, I'm afraid you're going to have to close the doors now. We've exceeded the fire regulations. And so that evening, the nervousness thinking about how many people would turn up and whether we were just a very few people concerned about this, suddenly transformed into this extraordinary uplifting evening for me, where you could feel this physical groundswell of concern and passion for doing something to try and save this place. It was so important to so many people. That was one example just of how striking public involvement, the people's involvement, how much people care about this place is. And I found that really moving. Another example was a few years back, since the area's been better protected, we've been able to spend much more of our time involved in trying to manage the site, to improve it for conservation, and do activities, nature-related activities, bringing people together into the area. And a few years back, we were trying to work with one of the local farmers to strengthen a hedge so that it would provide better protection for nesting lapwings on the other side. And it was plant hedges in the winter, and this was a freezing cold day in January, absolutely bitterly cold. It was the coldest day of the year so far, but it was the day we'd agreed to do the work. And so about seven or eight of us go out with a load of hedge plants and spades and start digging a trench, putting the plants in, and the more we work, the colder it gets, and it's getting the wind whips up and then it starts sleeting, and you're realizing this job is going to take you all day and you're going to get extremely cold. And then just as you're thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to be horrible, I see about 10 or 12 of my research students from the university coming down the path towards us, and they've come in on a train from Cambridge to help out. And in about a couple of hours later, the whole job's finished and we can go home and get warm. And that, again, just the idea that more people care about this than you might think is very heartening to me, and an important part of the value of the area. In terms of wildlife, there's so many things I see down there, and so many little treasures that you come across, often when you're not expecting it. It's hard to think which ones to mention most of all. Obviously, there's the spectacular and the very rare things like bitterns and otters, and seeing marsh harriers and so on. But some of the other things, for me, the real highlights in my mind are things that are perhaps more ordinary or perhaps less rare, but seeing barn owls quartering down the river on the far bank as you walk along on a summer's evening, and watching them going about their business, chasing, looking for voles. I always find absolutely captivating. Some summers, not every summer, walking down between the two pits, and for the first time that summer, suddenly hearing a nightingale and realizing that this extraordinary bird's come all the way from Africa to exactly the same little patch of bushes as it did the year before. And then coming back later on in the evening, and it'll be 10 o'clock and it's dark, and this bird is still singing this extraordinary song. And thinking that that little patch, that little bit just round the corner from your home, is also the home of this extraordinary creature, and it comes back thousands of miles to exactly the same spot because it's got what it needs. One of the encounters I most enjoyed in the wild space was a few years back now, and we were using it for a walk with lots of friends' children. Sunday afternoon. And it was a walk which my family have done for a few years now to commemorate a little girl, a friend's daughter who died tragically very, very young a few years back. And on the anniversary of her birthday each year, we go on a walk, try and take kids and do something fun to celebrate her life. And we were out walking along the flood meadow with a gaggle of other people's children. And suddenly Billy, our dog, goes off in front, and he spotted this little shape moving through the long grass, realised what it was, and I rushed on to get it, and it was a mole. And all my life as a naturalist, I've always seen lots of sign of moles, and I've seen dead moles, and I've seen bits of moles after things have tried to eat them and spat them out, but I've never seen a live mole. I've always wanted to see a live mole, and here was one just swimming on the surface of the grass just ahead of my dog. So I dived in front of it and scooped it up, held it in my hands. And then the extraordinary thing about a mole, if you hold it like that, is not only is it immensely soft, exciting to hold, but it's got incredible strength in its forelimbs. So we then lined the children up and we passed it from one to the other down the line, and then told each of them, you know, hold this in your hands and feel how strong it is and have a good look at it, because they're amazing creatures and they're all around us, but you may never see one again. And they all dutifully did this, and the mole was very well behaved and did squeeze between their fingers, and they all had a look at its fur and its tried to see its eyes and all this sort of thing. Passed it down the line and let it go, and then watched it dive into the patch of soft earth and disappear. And then the next day I went into, all very excited and buzzing about moles and how extraordinary they are. Next day I went into work, and I told a colleague of mine who knew I'd been looking for moles or trying to see moles for years. And he said to me, "Oh, that's fantastic, Andrew, but tell me one thing, tell me you didn't pick it up with all those kids around." And I said, "Why not?" And he just held up his hand and he said, "Because of this." And he's 65 and he's still got a big scar in his finger from when he picked one up when he was a kid. And I thought, well, I'm very lucky I didn't get into a lot of trouble that day. Anyway, marvels of a mole. So the problem that lots of us were facing in 2007 was, we knew this place was important. We knew it was important for wildlife, we knew it was important for local people, we knew it was under threat, but we didn't really know how best to try and protect it into the future. Part of it was already protected as a site of special scientific interest, but that was for the geological features that were buried underneath it, and it was only for a relatively small part of the area that was important for wildlife. And so our group and talked with others in the Wildlife Trust, in Natural England, and in the RSPB. And then one of our colleagues at the RSPB had the really quite exciting idea of the possibility of the SSSI being redesignated, the Site of Special Scientific Interest being designated not just for the geology but also for the wildlife features. And that sent us scurrying around all of the local naturalists to find what records they had of different creatures in the area. And when we put those together with what the Wildlife Trust and the RSPB and Natural England already knew, a picture began to emerge that actually, yes, there were enough what they call enough features in the area to designate, to have the area potentially designated as a site of special scientific interest for its birds as well as for its geology. And that then went through a series of considerations by Natural England. They agreed with RSPB's suggestion, and the end result was the nomination of the area as a site of special scientific interest. That process went on through one or two appeals, so it dragged out for quite a long time. But the feeling at the end, amongst all of us, at the I think it was in February 2009 when it finally reached, was confirmed, its status was confirmed by the Natural England Board, was one of just incredible excitement and relief. I remember coming back that day and the news had already got out. We'd all gone off to the meeting. Got back home that day onto email, and the emails that were starting to come in from people around Ely and from friends and from family and lots of people who'd been concerned and involved in the discussions up until then, the warmth and the excitement that people felt was really quite moving.